On this week's show, Apple Pay, a way to make single-touch payments using the iPhone. Then, we take a trek and explore the potential of Bitcoin in the distant future to other planets and beyond.
Then later, we sit down and chat with BitPay CEO and co-founder, Stephen Pair. I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Chas Ferguson.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralized. How's it going, everybody? This is Tony, and I'm here with Chaz, subbing for Gentry.
Hey, everybody.
And our newest co-host, Eric Martindale.
Hello.
Last week, Apple announced Apple Pay, and I just got iOS 8, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that because it is their entry into single-touch payments using the iPhone, and it looks pretty neat. I have yet to try it. I don't know any outlets that are doing it, and just wanted to get a little bit of a conversation going about this because there seems to be a lot of excitement about it, but I'm not necessarily sure how big it's going to be because it seems like the outlets are very limited. I know McDonald's was signed on to do it, but I know like Walmart and Best Buy aren't. So what do you think, Eric?
I don't know. I think Apple is really scrambling for relevance. They've lost a significant portion of market share. They lost their CEO. Tim Cook has stepped up. I really think that they're just trying to carve out relevance and catch up to what Google and the Android and the general open source community has done. I don't know.
It's interesting. I think you're right, and I think that there are some aspects of this that I really like, and there's some parts that I really don't like. It does seem like they were able to negotiate a cheaper percentage fee from the credit card companies to go forward with this, which really just tells you a lot about where Apple's at and what they're trying to aim for. And it makes me wonder if they're really innovating here, if they're just taking that little step up instead of, you know, really innovating and putting another game changer.
Yeah, it's great they're joining the payment space, but I really don't think they're doing anything that hasn't been done before. For example, Google Wallet.
Yeah, I think Apple's actually entering into a new phase in their company where it's less about innovation and disruptiveness and more about simply securing what they've built. You saw IBM go through this sort of in their evolution where they were originally a very innovative company and they're disruptive and a lot of disintermediation. But ultimately, once you transition across this sort of this loose boundary, you become a company where disruption and innovation becomes dangerous to your bottom line, and that's a great point about the credit cards being able to negotiate. They have a lower rate, right? So obviously they're just trying to secure some sort of recurring revenue, enough market share to contribute to their shareholders' bottom line, because after all, they are a public company, and they're frankly about making money. I think it's going to be extremely common for people to say, oh, they're not innovating anymore. Well, we're going to have to get used to that because it's going to be rare that Apple and large companies like that innovate at this point.
Yeah, it seems like they're moving into the I believe the word would be institution phase, much yep. like IBM did. And it seems like that. The only reason I'm not sure on that is because it's still pretty early in this phase. And it makes me wonder that like the response to the watch has been very meh. You know, no one's really blown away by it. And I don't know, I've never really worn a watch in my life. And most people I know younger than me don't wear a watch because they don't need it because they have a phone. I don't necessarily see the utility of it personally. It's not, I think if you're maybe, you know, going to the gym, working out, that's definitely a benefit. Other than that, I was really struggling to see why I would want to get this. And I think if they're going to remain someone who sells consumer goods as physical products, they do need to have that innovation part of their company, because what happens is I'm not sure if they would be able to keep up with an IBM. When I say that, I mean IBM has consistently maintained their business. They know what they are. Apple, I think, we're depending on that big, you know, that big press conference, that big keynote every year that will announce their new products for so long. And I think you're eventually going to hit a wall. And I'm wondering if this is the year where that wall was hit, or if it's something that might come in the future, or if they have something really awesome, you know, in the works. But it's interesting because they really defined consumer electronics for the past 5 or 6 years, actually since the iPod, really, and more than that. But and it's interesting to see them in that next phase. And it's also more interesting to see who are the companies that are actually going to disrupt. And I think that's a word that's kind of misused in tech a lot, because I think true disruption is not saving a nickel on on manufacturing costs. You know, that's not disruption. Disruption is completely changing a game, and it happens. Believe me, it does. It just, I think that definition of how it happens is really muddled now. And
yeah, I mean, this is the first real major product launch that CEO Tim Cook has undertaken at Apple. And I think you're absolutely right at understanding, like, this is Apple's identity to innovate. But they're going to try to hold on to that and hold on to the, like, the outside visibility of into that. But again, I still think it boils down to this is a centralized profit, for-profit company. And they're going to focus on optimizing their bottom line for their shareholders at the end of the day. They can have amazing people that work there, but what has taken hold of them is I don't think they're there to change the world anymore. I think they're there to exist as a company.
I'm not sure if they were ever there to change the world. I think that's to me, that's more like they were there to sell a lot of product. But with that being said, I do think the clear winner that has made Apple win is not what people think. I think it's their design aesthetic more than their quality of their products. Quality of the products does matter, but a good example is I have a MacBook Air. I went home. I saw my mom. My mom knows nothing about computers, and she's like, "That's a nice computer." And I'm like, "Why?" She's like, "Look how nice it is." And I'm like, "Okay." I'm like, "You don't know anything about what's in there," and you know, that didn't matter. What mattered is it was nice looking. And I mean, it's funny, but it's also the kind of thing where you go, how is that defined? And what are the new products they're creating? And what is that design aesthetic? It's really something they've done such a good job at. Like, I do disagree with some of their business practices. Everything's that walled garden. I don't like that. I never have. But the first Mac I ever received was in the past 6 months that I've used extensively. I do like it, and there's things I love about it. But the thing I like about it most is the design. You know, I think it looks fantastic. And I think that's something that Apple has really succeeded at. And I want to see them keep that up because I wish other companies would learn from that. It seems like they haven't as much as they should. I don't know how others view that, but that's how I personally see that. And it seems to me like we're coming to an era now where design means a lot, and that utilitarian steel just it looks cool. And if it looks cool, people are going to think it's cool. They're going to want it. It's like Beats headphones. You know, there's way better headphones for way less money. But you know, they have that name and they have that Dr. Dre affiliation, and they're smart enough to give it to celebrities to wear around on red carpets and to UFC fights and to whatever. So if you get that and you get enough people that are seen as cool by culture to like it, that people will like it, which really means nothing to the quality of the product.
Well, one of the things that Apple did do correctly, and this is part of their culture, this is their very thesis since the creation, since Wozniak and Steve Jobs created the company effectively, design has been the selling point. It is part of the product, mm-hmm. right? And that's why they've succeeded for the past, you know, 20, 30 years. And I think there's a lot to learn from that. The reason they're so successful is because they made the best looking, feeling product. Mm-hmm. They recognize that it wasn't always about the underlying technology, but rather how does it feel when you interact with it? It's not always the best technical solution that wins, as we saw. I mean, we're in an era of, x86, where x86, the multi-use processor, has won out over far superior solutions, but it's because it was a better experience. And mm-hmm. this is an accretion. I think the Bitcoin community, the cryptocurrency community, crypto finance in general, has a lot of notes to take from how Apple got to where they are. And why are we looking at them like as if they're, you know, the number one leader in the space, which they have been. They've lost market share, but we are looking to them. And the reason of that is they focused correctly on design and experience over the underlying technical component. You can have the cure to cancer. You can have, you know, nuclear fusion at room temperature. You can do amazing technical things, but it's just not going to take off without a solid user experience wrapped around it. And I think we need to see a lot more of that before some of these amazing technical things that we're seeing in cryptocurrency sort of take off.
Yeah, and bringing it back to the Bitcoin aspect, one thing that's concerning me about Apple Pay is they're restricting use of NFC technology to Apple Pay. So we're not going to be able to see any Bitcoin wallets on the iPhone 6. And I think that's the direction that Bitcoin is going, get rid of QR codes.
I agree.
I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. I do agree. But I also think that it's something where it's a catch-22 for users, but I think Apple's going to eventually give in, like they've given in on other things. Again, prognostication. I don't know anything, but it seems to me like what's going to happen is people that want to use NFC will find a way, but they're going to need to jailbreak their phone, which therefore makes your phone way less secure. So why would you want to keep if you're going to have $5 on there, fine, but why would you want to keep a lot of money in your Bitcoin wallet on a jailbroken phone is beyond me. But I think you're going to see the technology work in different ways, and you're going to see competitors come out, albeit, something will work out with Google, with Android, and eventually they're going to have to give in on that. I don't know when, it's like with the App Store. Originally, the App Store was something that wasn't available, and people modded their phones, so that their iPhones, so they could install third-party apps. And Apple's like, wait, we can make money on this. And I think once that light bulb turns on and they go, oh, we can make money off this, you're going to see that's going to be a feature that's re-implemented. I think right now they're trying to protect Apple Pay from any possible competition like Bitcoin. Until it's implemented, I should say, because eventually I think it will be implemented in their ecosystem. Just don't know when.
I think Bitcoin has a long way to come before Apple pays serious attention to it. Again, this gets back to their core design philosophy and placing design at the forefront of their business. The Bitcoin community, the cryptocurrency community at large, just does not meet the design standards of Apple. Mm-hmm. Apple will not put a product in front of users that is not a seamless experience. Now they can fail at delivering that, as we've seen, a couple of times, like this U2 album thing where they forcibly put U2 on everybody's phones.
But I want to talk more about that in a minute, by the way. But go ahead, continue.
Yeah, it's just like Bitcoin not only needs more energy and more momentum. I don't have exact numbers on the number of wallets out there, but the percentage of those wallets that belong to people who have Apple devices, I'm not sure what that percentage is either. But I imagine it's significantly smaller than the overall Bitcoin community, obviously. But do they have a reason to really make a stance on we'll do Bitcoin or we won't do Bitcoin, whatever that may be? And yeah, we saw the re-addition of some Bitcoin-related products to the iTunes Store, but that's the thing that bothers me about all of it, is that we're still letting Apple be the gatekeepers to this.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Forget that. Like, let's just build something on top of it. And I would, prefer to know what every single line of code on my phone is doing. I would prefer to be able to audit everything, and I would feel much more secure knowing that my code doesn't have a backdoor and Apple can't put things onto my device. And that's sort of the momentum and the reasoning behind having a jailbroken device or having Android over something else, is you're asserting your right to the freedom of being able to modify your device's behavior. So you're not at the behest of the software designer, and you have to use it the way they want you to use it. You have the freedom to change that behavior if you want.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that more so than a business decision to sort of cut one thing off or turn it on, I think it's up to us to gain more momentum in the Bitcoin community and really take leadership on decentralizing and exercising our right to that freedom.
Yeah, and I think I think you're 100% right on that, and this is going to go back to what we were talking about a second ago, not just about U2, but about their design aesthetic. For a company that cares so much about, their design, their the perception of the people that purchase their product or want to purchase their product, they need to give the fuck up on U2. Like, okay, now, do you want your product to be seen as something that people who are listening to dad rock want to listen to? Like, okay, fine, if that's the case, but when I saw that live performance, and I kind of knew they were performing because it was rumored, and I'm like, really, again? Like, okay, it was cool and novel 10 years ago. And U2 were not new or cool 10 years ago when they had that first U2 iPod. So then when I saw that, I'm thinking, like, okay, so this is clearly their market. Like, that's who they want. They don't necessarily want to be as cool and hip as I perceive it. They want people that just want an easy experience, which they've kind of admitted, and that's really been a part of their product marketing for a while. But to me, I see that, and I just I was like, really? I mean, I'm an ICP fan, and I was embarrassed to have that U2 record on my iPhone. I was just like, you know, and that's saying something, you know? And it's just, to me, it was a massive mess up, and it was also completely U2 working sound scan, so they're going to count those as scans, kind of like how Prince did when he released his record with the ticket. So it looked like he had a number one album when in reality he did not sell that many records. Like, okay, U2, but then it's also the price to pay for that record is going to be baked in on the Apple cost of whatever product they release. So people are paying for it. U2 didn't do that for free, and I know it. And I see that, and I go, why do they have anything to do with this? Like, I can think of 10 bands off the top of my head. Get Paul McCartney. There's someone that's more universal. A lot of people like the Beatles a lot more that like than like U2. Get him. There's so many interesting, cool people that could have done this, and they pick U2. Like, this is me just being a music nerd complaining, because I'm just like, I looked at that, and when they started performing, I'm like, is this the lamest thing? Like, I'm trying to think of someone lamer, and there's plenty of people that are way worse, don't get me wrong. But there's no one that just makes me go, ugh, more.
There's no one else that would sell out.
Yeah. To me, it's not even selling out, because it's like, I never really thought U2 had credibility in the first place. I always thought Bono was a hypocrite, but he is. And I thought the U2 or the South Park episode about him being the number two was the funniest thing ever, because it's true. Like, you can tell, like, there's something that bothers Bono really bad. And I don't know. I don't want this to turn into a U2 rant thing, but when that happened, I thought it was funny at first. And then I saw the people getting mad, and then Apple actually had to release, like, instructions for people to remove it. And I was like, that's hilarious. Like, this backfired hugely on them. And it wasn't even that big of a deal. Like, oh, free album. But, you know, when you got a free, that Jay-Z record came out for free, if you didn't want it, it was unknown to you.
Yeah. So the iPod's original launch had a U2 album on it, right? Or a song or something like that.
I think, like, one of the first two.
Okay.
Like, the second, I don't remember the gen, but it was one of the first ones, because they did a U2 exclusive iPod. It was
right.
Like red and black, and it came out when Vertigo came out and stuff.
So is this a case where Tim Cook is trying to strike the same chords as Steve was when he launched this admittedly world-changing product?
I would say probably, because U2 are striking those same chords in their music today that they did 10 years ago. They're not any different. Like,
yeah.
I mean, and that's why I wonder, like, you know. Like, when I see people interested in Bitcoin, it's usually cool people. Like, I mean, yeah, it's artists I like Death Grips, and, like, obviously Shooter, who was on last week, likes it. But, you know, I hear Joe Rogan talking about it. I hear people that are actually interested in new ideas. And none of these seem like new ideas. They just seemed like Malibu Stacy with a different hat. Like, oh, we're finally, you know, doing something a little different. And it is a little different. But it's not anything I'm rushing to go home. Like, I want this. Ever. Even close.
Yeah. No, it's funny. You do raise a very good point. Is the market that they're going after people who just really don't want to care about what their device is, how the technology works, or, you know, who they're interacting with. They just want to have an easy experience. And it just kind of underscores, like, to me, and I'll probably offend some people when I say this, but to me, if you willingly use proprietary software or proprietary platform, you are completely giving away a freedom with full knowledge that you can't change things about it. You're
mm-hmm.
saying, I no longer want to exercise this freedom. And this U2 thing, I don't particularly care what artist it was, this idea of, like, forcibly imposing something on someone just fundamentally bothers me.
And using your data, so it's costing people that weren't on Wi-Fi.
Absolutely. So unwilling use of their data to download the over the air, right? Okay, that's also a violation of rights. But it's like any sort of like transgression against my rights without me saying like, oh, I will be using your service. So anytime you use a cloud service, you're giving them your data in
mm-hmm.
exchange for the service, effectively. It's a business transaction. If you aren't paying for a product, chances are you are the product, right?
Yeah.
It's the same case as in Facebook. What, you know, the billion Facebook users that are out there don't may or may not realize, and I think are increasingly realizing, is that Facebook is using their attention as their product, and they're selling it to the advertisers. And if we can just increase awareness to make people realize that when they interact with something that's free, that is on someone else's platform, that is proprietary, you're entering into a business contract that says, I'm giving you this data. and you're going to go make money off of it in exchange for the free service you're providing to me. And that's really what bothers me about this YouTube thing and Apple at large, the iTunes, and all of their proprietary software.
It's unsettling. I agree. What do you say, Chaz?
I mean, I agree with Eric.
Yeah, I think it's something where we are all pretty much on the same page here. I also think it's something where we're the exceptions. Most people don't think about it, don't care. They may think it's funny because they were forced to download a YouTube record and they don't like it and they're going to say, they're going to complain on Facebook. But other than that, what are people going to do, really? Like, you know, is someone going to go punch Bono in the face or punch Edge in the face? Well, I'm not that we're saying they should, but they should give them a big tongue lashing. Shame on you.
They should get really angry and go build a decentralized music distribution platform is what they should do.
Absolutely.
To eliminate iTunes and its relevance. I mean, they're already waning, right? Mm-hmm. So what can we do to build something that makes it so there is no third party that, you know, forces things upon you? You opt into this new system.
Yeah. I think that you're right, and I think that's one of the, I think that's the main reason Apple acquired Beats, right? It really wasn't for the headphones. It was for the streaming service, which, by the way, I'm a big Trent Reznor fan, and I heard that he was heavily involved with it, and I was massively disappointed. And I was like, why can't I just search an artist and hit play? But for all the complaints there are, I actually do like Spotify. I think it works remarkably well. If I want to hear a song, if it's not on there, oh well, but if it is on there, it's easy to find. It's just, I like a lot of things about it, but That Beats streaming music software, I was just massively disappointed by.
You know what's really interesting? CBS acquired Last.fm, which was a music streaming service.
Yes,
and a data store, right?
Mm-hmm.
So their big tool was that you could, in most media players that were popular at the time, iPod, iTunes included, you could install a little plugin. You could listen to your music, and what it would do is it would just share what you were listening either
Absolutely.
Among your friends or just for your own personal posterity back to this web service. So, you know, like I do in, you know, 10 years, mm-hmm. like you can go back and look, what was I listening to at this point in time? Which I think is extremely powerful. But most interestingly to me is Last.fm, after the CBS acquisition, is decommissioning their streaming service. You know, this is many years into their life cycle as a business. They're decommissioning their radio streaming and are focusing exclusively on the data, right? The data manipulation and scrobbling and being able to keep track of these things. Mm-hmm. And I think that signals, by and large, a movement towards this data as value economy that we've already entered. But the expansion of this data as value economy is taking place, and it's disrupting a lot of business models from the RIAA and the MPAA and their, you know, violent assertion of rights over artists.
Evil.
It's ridiculous.
It is, and it's something where I agree with what you're saying, but I also think there's another part of it why they're disassociating themselves with that service is royalties. There's a lot of tangled webs in there. And then I think the fact that most people that use Last.fm used it so they could scrabble their music, like, it bums me out that I can't easily scrabble SoundCloud. I think we had this conversation when I first met you, and I said, I want a way where when I walk into a store and I hear a song, a Shazam-like service figures out the song and scrabbles it. I want to scrabble every song I hear in life. Yes, that's insane. I admit that. But I want that feature. So when a music player does not have that feature, I'm like, why? Like, SoundCloud, to me, needs that feature. And because they're used a lot, you know, and Spotify has it. It's baked right in. It's easy to turn on and whatever you're using
Absolutely.
It on. And I enjoy that greatly. But I think that I don't know. I don't have firsthand knowledge. But I think that you're right on that, on the part that does have value, though, and that people are seeing that has value. Because to me, that's more accurate than any Billboard chart. SoundScan numbers, I know this from personal experience, can be very heavily manipulated easily. And I would never trust those anyways as far as how successful something is. I would actually trust iTunes more, but I would trust Last.fm more than both.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I don't think you're crazy at all. You are, by the very nature of your desire there, you're saying, like, look, my information has value mm-hmm. to me. It's valuable to me to have this data over time. I want to be able to go back and see, what was I listening to? You know, what was that one song at the store? You know, I didn't have time to pull my phone out or whatever
Absolutely.
It was. And then, like, see trends. Like, that's valuable to you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not you have to trust a third party to gain wisdom and insight into that is a determination of your own will. Ideally, we can have a decentralized way of doing this, like a persistent internet file system that you can just share the stuff onto, encrypt it, and then retrieve it later. But giving away that information for free is well, giving away, like, it's like walking down the street and handing out dollar bills, right? It's just, it doesn't make any sense to me because it does have value. Why give it away for free? You should be the sole owner of that data because you are the producer of it.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's just all about realigning what the perception of value is for data and how, you know, you have the RIAA and the MPAA that still, I think, are of the mindset of 25, 30 years ago where, you know, you could control who had your music and who didn't because you controlled the supply chain, you know, other than, and you know, that even wasn't true because there were people taping it off the radio or taping their friends. But, you know, you saw them control that, and, you know, they don't copy that floppy and all that other nonsense. And you kind of see, okay, and then you see this happen. And when the music industry failed to admit that the value of a digital track is, for one, up to the person that wants it, two, there's no price that needs to be spent to do anything other than production cost. So you're massively reducing that. And then when you charge $20 for a CD, no wonder no people stop buying it. Like, come on. And Shooter talked about the same thing, too, and he's in the music industry, and he sees this, he sees that comment, and he definitely is someone who sees things like iTunes as an enemy because they're not treating artists right. They're not, you know, and a lot of other things. And it's not just that they're not treating it right. It's that, you know, it's not a pleasant transaction for those involved. Like, I thought once I had a Mac that iTunes would work wonderfully. No, Mac, iTunes is terrible software even on a Mac. Like, I was shocked by how bad it was. I was like, wow, it isn't any better. Why is iTunes so bad? Like, it's really hard
Monopoly.
To use. Oh, it, yeah, absolutely. And I think it's slowly losing it,
yeah,
which is funny because Apple's, you know, still in control of a lot of it, but...
And this is the thing, is like even radio and taping things off the radio wasn't a new concept. Prior to radio's widespread adoption, music was still written by artists and it was still distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about fake books, right? Like aspiring musicians or musicians in general would have fake books that has all the music in them and they would be able to play it and distribute these things. You know, sort of, it was kind of taboo, but... Fake books was a precursor to even the radio distribution of music, which ideally drives adoption and sales of the physical records, which, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. But this isn't a new problem. But now that we have the internet, you can't stop the signal. If somebody wants to publish something, now they can. And this has been a point that has been belabored, but. We're totally full bore into this new data as value economy.
Absolutely. With that being said, I do want to wrap this conversation topic up, but I'm fascinated by it. And I think the one thing I want to say finally is that whatever the technology is, no business is ever doing good business when they are suing their clientele who are interested in their product. It's a fail. It's a fail when they sue people, even if they download it illegally, because you're getting nothing out of it. These are people that would pay for your product that probably never will now, and it makes you look bad. It's a failure in every form and fashion. So I can't believe the RIAA ever did that. Look at the backlash Metallica got. It's not positive. And I think as a business method, it's just bad. But I think we could put that to sleep. But there is one other huge topic we wanted to talk about, and that's space. And outer space is pretty cool. And NASA announced that they will be returning manned space flight to low Earth orbit, I believe, and then in the more distant future, past that. So what do you think about that announcement?
Well, I think it's a political move, actually, to because, you know, previously we were sending astronauts to space with Russia, right? So we were paying Russia to send our astronauts into space. So I think it's mainly a political move. To, you know, stop supporting Russia. But I think it's really good. I'm glad NASA is not going away.
I don't know how I feel about NASA.
Yeah, having a government organization that is in control of, I mean, granted, they pioneered things, but I don't really buy this idea of having a centralized, responsible agency for controlling my freedom to go where I would like. And if I want to go to space, I damn well am going to be going to space.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that I would like to be able to pick and choose, you know, which of these options do I have to get into space, right? And a centralized government organization just is not that to me.
I don't know. I don't know on this. I always say I have never made up my mind, and it's something I think about every year or so because I'll think about NASA and I'll go, okay, I really think it's cool. I think it's a very noble goal. I think great things have came out of this program and our government doing it. But then I think, is it their role? Is it something that we should all be paying for? Is this something that, you know, I think private companies are finally starting to get in on this game, and I actually think are upping the ante. And I think it's very cool. It's one of those things I want to do before I die. I want to go on one of those trips. Like, I want to go to low Earth orbit. I think that's awesome. So I can totally see why all the celebrities sign up for it. It's really cool. But I also think, what's the goal here? And I think they've said different things. I've heard different goals. I don't necessarily know. But I do think that it's smart as for survival of humanity that we need to keep pushing these boundaries. And I think that – let me rephrase that. I wish more private dollars would go into this because you have some brave folks that are doing it. You know, Branson with Virgin Galactic, the SpaceX folks. There's some people that are really doing a great job on the private enterprise side here. I hope they continue to push that boundary because it's something that's really important for the future, like the distant future. We probably won't even live to, you know, gain from this, but –
Well, I mean, look, the Cold War, the previous, you know, trouble between Russia and the United States drove a lot of the space race,
yep.
Right, ultimately.
History repeats itself.
It's funny. You never really think that it would happen so quickly, right? It's been, mm-hmm. what, 30 years? But here we are again. And Chaz, I think your point is totally, totally correct. This is definitely a political play. We are trying to exert pressure on Russia for their not only their recent economic actions with China, but their military actions in Ukraine and some of the other previous transgressions that have been taking place. It's definitely pressure that we're pushing back. It may also be a play for more money, right? Like, they have been systematically cut down and defunded over the past, you know, decade, 15 years. And that's just unacceptable in terms of if there is going to be some organization, whether it be private or centralized, which I disagree with the centralized solution, I think it's absolutely essential, not just smart for the human race, for the survival of human race. It's essential. We have got to get to the stars. And if we don't, we will die and evaporate, and humanity will never be seen or heard from again. We have to get to the stars, and it's not just my objective to get to the stars before I – or get to orbit before I die. You know, I will get to the stars, right? I mean, we start talking about human longevity, and look, that is the next big thing, right, is being able to go beyond Earth, beyond the moon, to the other planets in our solar system, to the other stars, and explore. Like, the amount that of the universe that exists out there that we can't even see or observe is so massive. The universe is a huge place, and we've seen none percent of it, zero, mm-hmm. right? We are a speck, as Carl Sagan said. We are a pale blue dot in this giant sea of darkness, right? There's so much else out there, and to me, it just sort of ignites this fuel of adventure, and, like, that is my dream, is I want to go amongst the stars and explore.
Yeah, absolutely. But as much as I hate to say it, I think it's going to be really difficult until we find a way to make space exploration profitable, right? If there's not any money in it, nobody's going to pay to build all of these rockets.
I think space tourism is a very good start.
There's a lot more than just space tourism already, too, though.
So mining.
There's space mining companies, yep. that are, I think in 2015, they'll be launching their first prototype, actually. SpaceX's Elon Musk, I believe, is on the board of this company. There might be a couple other former PayPal guys there. It's Interplanetary Resources. Planetary Resources, I think, is the company name. And they've got some pretty heavy hitters on that team. And that's exactly what it is. This encouragement of the individual, the private individual, to enter into a potential for returning capital for a capital investment is what will drive this. In the interest of the United States, it was a centralized organization. It was the U.S. government with NASA that was actually seeking, if you think about it, they were seeking out the capitalist idea of, you know, gaining more capital and more physical space and ownership for military reasons, of course. But that's still a type of capital, being able to exert force over someone else, I imagine. That's what drove it. And you're right. I want to see more private individuals doing this because then they have less questionable motives. But we've got to open that up. What I would be cautious of is NASA or any other organization establishing rules over how these private individuals are allowed to go into space. Don't tell me what I'm allowed to do.
No, you know it's happening too.
Oh, of course. I mean, we see it right now with like these arguments over drones, right?
Yeah,
you know, you're not allowed to fly, you know, a remote controlled aircraft above X feet.
Which is hysterical because they've had remote control helicopters for decades, and it was just they were just called remote control helicopters. Now they're all drones.
Yeah, it's called them all drones. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of funny. This may bite them in the ass, right? Because drones, you know, was popularized by, you know, the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, mm-hmm. right? You know, we've got these giant wet flying weapons that are dropping bombs and killing people, and we call them drones, and that's what they were in the media. So now there's like this natural fear against it, and it sort of like stirs this dissent among the population. They're like, I don't know about this drone thing. So they start to question, I hope they start to question, and I hope they start to research and realize, like, these drones are just
acting on behalf of individuals.
RCs and, yeah. Like,
yeah, and I think that, you know, when we're talking about all of this, technology scares a lot of people. And they see things like that, and they're terrified. And I can see why they're terrified, but then I can kind of think of, well, you know, someone's controlling it. It's not exactly just a robot thinking itself, and I'm not saying it won't be at some point. But I am saying that right now it's not. And you know, I think that it's kind of weird where there's different, I guess, positions people have on it, and, you know, it's this positive and negative in pretty much everything. And, you know, I do want to loop this back around to space and what we're talking about and being decentralized, and a project that someone that I actually got to meet when I came down to here to Atlanta, which is Jeff Garzik, is working on, which is BitSat, which is going to be a hosted version of the blockchain that's going to be a satellite. And I think that's an awesome idea. And I think I think that in any political discussion, there's one variable that can't change, and that's information. The more information you have, and I'm not saying everyone can process it the same, but the better chance you're going to have an actual free society. And I think of things like satellites as ways that countries like North Korea and to some degree China, which, you know, behind the firewall, which you can get around, but not exactly easy if you're behind it, and things like that, where we have a chance to, and same with, you know, Africa, which if you see does not have much internet access at all, you're going to see access to information in these countries grow. And it may be slow because it's satellite technology, but you're going to see it grow. And that is necessary. And that is going to be a huge part of what takes us to these steps of how we get to the stars. Because all these minds that don't have access to information or education, and to me, access to information is education. It's not, I don't mean formal schooling. I mean access to facts and, you know, perceived facts, I should say, online. You're going to see people, the smartest people in these countries, be able to contribute to humanity in a way where they never could. And think of all those millions of people that will now, you know, will be able to have the smartest of those contributing to these projects. That is a very noble goal that I think is very near in the future, and it's going to be fantastic.
Agreed. Anything that we can do to disseminate information, accurate information, is going to help this cause of decentralization, right?
Mm-hmm.
Information is power, and powers that be recognize that, and they will do anything they can to disrupt the flow of information if that power flow does not suit them. Mm-hmm. Power corrupts absolutely, and we can speak in all of these, you know, common phrases all we want, but at the end of the day, access to information is going to be what empowers the individual to capitalize on what it is that he wants and his individual liberties and freedoms.
Yeah, and to make this slightly political before we, you know, get on to our awesome interview with Stephen, will be the fact, the goings on in Ferguson, and the resistance, yet the embracing of cameras. I know a police officer, and it's here in the rural South. It's not anywhere here in Atlanta. And everyone in his little department, and it's a very small department, wears cameras on their badges. And when you ask him about what he thinks about it, he absolutely loves it. And you know why he loves it? Because he goes, you know, he's like, I always did what I was supposed to do. You know, I never abused it. But, you know, we would get accused of it because, you know, people are people. And he's like, I love it. He's like, I just show them the video and go, I did not do anything wrong. I did not assault you. You know, your rights were violated. You know, this is the example of a good cop, the guy that you want, you know, on your streets. And he absolutely loves it. And when I see people like him speaking on it, I go, like, that's awesome. Because you know what? There are a lot of great people out there. And this transparency protects them because that information is now available to the public. So when transparency protects them, I think that that's something that people fail to realize. People think, oh, I want privacy. Well, if you're being paid by the public, I think for your work shift, you don't have that right anymore. I think politics, if politicians should all be forced to give away their privacy while they're in office. Now, when they're out of office, 100% private is what they want. But while you're in office and we're paying you, this should be private. This is only my personal opinion, of course, but I think that it's that access to information. It's information. That's what it's about. And it's about getting that, you know, getting that information and processing it however you want. And it's something where learning that really changed how I thought about a lot of things. And it made me realize, you know, why is it that when you meet someone that's older, sometimes they have racist views, or sometimes, and I say older, like 70s, 80s, you know, and it's like, well, they were raised in a time where that was completely normal. And, you know, they didn't grow up on the internet talking to someone when they were 13 from a different country. That's completely alien to them. And then you think of, but I did, and that's why I don't share those feelings, because I know they're ridiculous. But you are a product of what you know. Exactly. And that's how I'll break it down for that. Any final words, Eric or Chaz? You can go on about my long pseudo-political rant or anything else you wanted to discuss.
Look, I look forward to a day when I can elect into a contract with my chosen police force who, whether they have body cameras or not, would be my personal decision. I want this enforcement agency to protect me for the laws that I agree to. Mm-hmm. Similarly with politicians. I mean, I agree with you. I think if you hold a public office, you should live a public life, and you become a public asset.
Yeah.
Therefore, you need to be open book, period.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who may disagree with that. I would look forward to a day where I can enter into a contract to agree to one system or another or some other and cooperate with people that also agree with similar contracts.
Absolutely. I agree completely. Cool. And I'm getting the nod of no for Chaz. I think he agrees, or maybe not, or doesn't want to talk about it. But either way, he's doing an amazing job producing this show. So I just wanted to say thanks to Chaz Ferguson here and Eric Martindale, who is going to be a co-host here. And I'm really excited to have. He's one of the brightest guys I know. And having his opinion on different subjects here, as you can tell from today's talk, has been fantastic. So we're getting geared up for this to be a fantastic podcast. And as it gets better, you will all hear it. And you'll get to see our evolution. And it's going to be great.
Earlier, Tony and Gentry sat down and spoke with Stephen Pear. Stephen is the CEO and co-founder of BitPay, the largest payment processor in the Bitcoin space. He's also a renowned software engineer and open source advocate.
Hi, Stephen. How are you doing?
Great.
Great. It's awesome to talk with you today. I'm actually going to let Gentry go with the first.
Sure. As a co-founder of BitPay, there's a lot of history there. How did you actually first get involved with software development?
I used to sneak onto my dad's TRS-80 Model 1 back when I was about 7 or 8 years old. That's going back to the late 1970s. So he had this computer, and it really fascinated me. And, you know, it was a very expensive computer at the time. You know, I used to have to sneak around to get onto it. I'm sure he knew I was doing that, but I used to, you know, I started out writing basic programs, and in those days we had tape drives, so you tended to do a lot of transcribing of programs from paper into a computer and then running them. So
That's interesting. Now, if I'm correct, isn't TRS, wasn't that Tandy?
Tandy, yeah.
Isn't it interesting that Radio Shack is speaking of declaring bankruptcy when they had such a big part of the first, I would say what is one of the first internet PC booms, and the TRS was like a de facto standard along with, you know, the Apple, Apple II, well, Apple II really.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me because I went to an elementary school, and we actually had one, and this was like 1994, so obviously they were really far
behind.
You had
a TRS-80 in 90.
We did. It was awesome. Yeah, and we had a Commodore 64. Those were our big computers, yeah. So when you went to computer class, you played around with those,
yeah.
And I thought it was awesome because, you know, it was very interesting because it felt like a different world,
mm-hmm.
So I can understand.
It was definitely a different world.
Absolutely. And with that being said, you know, you have a long history with cryptocurrencies. I've heard a lot about, you know, it going back for a while. When did you start becoming interested in the idea, and, you know, how did that come to be?
I got fascinated with something called DigiCash back in the 1990s. And this is, I guess, early to mid-1990s. DigiCash is what I would consider the first cryptographic payment system. It was a centralized system, but it used cryptographic algorithms to secure the actual payment transactions. So I was a big fan of that and studied and followed that very closely. And then around about the same time was when Phil Zimmerman was getting PGP out there, and so I was following, you know, I was very fascinated just by encryption algorithms and being able to communicate and it was kind of fun to think about taking this text and converting it into something that was scrambled and then only certain people could decrypt it. And then I also got very interested in economics and how markets work and, you know, how central banking works. And all of those together kind of got me very interested in answering the question of how do you take this thing that is it's a worthless piece of paper with worthless ink on it, and yet people assign it value, you know, physical paper currencies. The fact that it's worthless paper and worthless ink told me that it was an information system, and if it's an information system, it should be possible to do that in a computer. And, you know, I thought a lot about how you would do that back in the 1990s. And then there was sort of this period in the late 90s and early 2000s where not much really seemed to be happening, you know, and I had a day job and couldn't spend a whole lot of time working on the problem, but I did think a lot about it.
That's interesting, and I think during the early 2000s, different kind of peer-to-peer, I would say, would you consider BitTorrent to almost be a sole or precursor, I would say, the sole of it, I don't know necessarily the term, but of something like Bitcoin, where it's not necessarily, the technology is different, but in the same token, it has that same distributed content system. I would say, I don't know if that's the best way to describe it. You could probably do a better version.
You sort of mean like a philosophical forum?
Yeah, absolutely, where you could share files without necessarily paying for the server space. You know, you could get something out there to a massive amount of people with a very small piece of info.
You know, I don't, aside from a few technical things that it does similar, BitTorrent does similarly to Bitcoin, I don't think of Bitcoin as being like a precursor or anything. I don't think of it being that related to Bitcoin at all, actually. You know, some of the way that Bitcoin assembles transactions into a block is very similar to the way files are decomposed and distributed on the BitTorrent network. But, you know, outside of that, I really don't see a very strong kind of connection. You know, the real innovation in Bitcoin is this consensus algorithm that's based on proof of work, and you know, no other system has anything like that. And that's the real heart of Bitcoin. And, you know, that came about through many people on the Cypherpunks mailing list hashing out and, you know, really just thinking about this problem of how you eliminate the centralized nature of, you know, currencies or digital currencies. So that process, you know, Hashcash and B-Money and a number of others kind of led up to Bitcoin. And those I regard as being sort of the precursors, not BitTorrent.
Interesting.
Well, and that that core theoretical computer science problem is the Byzantine generals problem, mm-hmm. I believe. Academically, had it been sort of like there was a lot of work that was incrementally building up to this breakthrough, or was it more that there hadn't been a lot of progress and Bitcoin was kind of a shot in the dark out of nowhere to solve that?
You're talking about the period from the late 90s to early 2000s where there wasn't a lot of progress?
Well, I'm talking about both then, but really even coming up to Bitcoin, would you describe the evolution of finding a solution to that theoretical problem as, a constant incremental thing, or as Satoshi came up with something truly novel that no one else had really dabbled around with?
No, I think it's more incremental. Satoshi just ended up putting all the pieces together in the right way.
Sure.
It wasn't the first time, Bitcoin isn't the first time people considered using proof of work, for example, as part of the design of the system.
And with that being said, when did you first hear the word Bitcoin?
Not much longer after it was introduced. It was in 2009, early 2009. I think you could probably go back and look it up on Slashdot, but I heard, I saw an announcement about it on Slashdot. And at the time I read that announcement, I had thought a lot about this problem, which was both good and bad. I had thought a lot about economics and things like that. And so the Slashdot blurb said, essentially, run this computer algorithm and generate money. And my economics brain told me that can't possibly work. So I kind of disregarded it for a while, up until late 2010, which is when I finally sat down and read the Satoshi white paper. And that's when I realized, that's when my background helped me, because when I read that white paper, it was immediately apparent to me what they had done and what they had accomplished. It wasn't just that the people were running some algorithm and generating money. They were securing the payment system, and this was how you introduced the currency into circulation. So
that's fascinating, because I think that's something where most people have that aha moment, that light bulb moment where it goes, oh, I had it, and when I finally understood it, it was like, this is really clever. This is genius. Yeah. I love it.
I think if you have a computer science background and you've spent a lot of time or spent some time thinking about this problem, then with that context, and when you read the Satoshi white paper, it's so simple, straightforward, just a few pages, and oftentimes solutions that are they almost look obvious when you read them, and that I think it's the same experience a lot of people have when they read the white paper and do have some of that background.
Absolutely. I think it's something with other technologies throughout history that's happened very similarly, too. I know there was a big uproar when electricity was announced, and they thought that the World's Fair would be the only time it was ever used, and that it was too unsafe to use in houses, that they would burn down. And, that really...
It was pretty unsafe back
then. Well, yeah. And it's the same thing when people say, oh, it's volatile. Well, yeah, it is right now. Yeah. And it's going to change. And, I think that there's faith in that, and from everyone in the community, that's why there's, optimism. And a lot of folks say that it's not warranted, and I disagree completely. But I also think that it's important to view it, in my terms at least, as a technology. I tried to take my economic brain out of it, because that's just something where I don't have enough knowledge. But as a technology, I see it and I go, wow, this really works well. And once you kind of understand it in that way, I think it makes you more open to it in other ways. Mm-hmm. Personally, this is from what I've seen from people I've talked about it with. So, and with that being said, you said it was 2010. So in 2011, you started BitPay with Tony. How exactly did that come to be? And what made you decide, okay, this is what I want to do and what the kind of business I want to start?
Well, when I read the white paper, I knew this is what I wanted to do. I had been looking around for various ideas for a long time to start up a new company. I had been part of actually three prior startups. And I wanted to get – at the time, I was working in a large company, and I wanted to get back into a startup environment and do something that I was interested in working on. And I was open to joining a startup or starting my own. And when I read the I had – considered lots of different ideas. Nothing really jumped out at me until I read the Satoshi white paper and got really excited about Bitcoin and dove into the source code and started refactoring the Satoshi client and just really learning it. That was in early 2011. I played around with a couple of different ideas. And then I started talking to Tony. Tony and I kept up on Facebook, and he and I were both interested in – I talked to Tony a lot about trading stocks and options and things like that. And so when I got interested in Bitcoin, I told Tony about it, and you know, his advice to me was sell it before it crashes, right? And he was a skeptic like I was when I first heard about it. And but I kept talking to him about it, and after a while, he started to come around, and then he wrote, you know, a long email about the idea for BitPay, and I replied back to him, you know, let's do it. You know, we had talked about doing exchanges, you know, getting into various aspects of the Bitcoin ecosystem, but we felt like making it easy for businesses to accept Bitcoin was a natural fit, and there really weren't many people trying to do it at that time. There were a few, but they weren't very good, and we felt like it was a good, you know, it was using Bitcoin for what it was designed for, and making it easier for, you know, people in the traditional world, you know, world of finance traditional world of commerce to be able to use this technology. And we saw all the advantages, like that, you know, it could eliminate a lot of the problems you have with using credit cards on the internet. It could reduce the cost tremendously. So.
Awesome. I also think that, you know, with Bitcoin came a ton of other cryptocurrencies, and I can't even count. I have no idea what the count is lately. Mm-hmm. What's your opinion of them, and what is your alternate opinion, I should say, or a differing opinion of Dogecoin, Litecoin, the ones that are the biggest that people seem to speak about the most?
Well, you use the example of electricity, right? Mm-hmm. Back in the early days of electricity, there's this big debate over AC versus DC.
Yes.
And AC ultimately won out for its properties, its ability to transmit over long distances. But there was very vocal opponents to AC because it was dangerous, a lot more dangerous than DC, and you know, could kill people. And but today you don't. In fact, I think a few years ago, the very last DC electricity distribution system in New York was shut down. I think that was fairly recently, actually. So the world kind of settled on a standard, and I think you'll see the same thing around Bitcoin. Bitcoin has the most powerful computing network, securing that payment system by several orders of magnitude, but probably several orders of magnitude more powerful than all of the other altcoins combined. In addition to that, there's a much more liquid market for Bitcoin. So if you look at, you know, anybody that's using Bitcoin, there needs to be this liquid market both for goods and services as well as exchange into other currencies. And again, Bitcoin is orders of magnitude more liquid than any of those, any of those altcoins, and probably all of them combined. So I don't see any competitor would have to overcome that in order to have a chance at finding widespread adoption. On the other hand, I think those altcoins they're interesting experiments, and they can show us things that we might not be able to experiment with and learn on the real Bitcoin blockchain. And if there's something that is, if there's a worthwhile concept or idea, I'm sure it will get adopted in one form or another into the Bitcoin ecosystem.
Yeah, going off that point, you know, I think a key difference there is that most of the activity around altcoins tends to be speculative mm-hmm. in nature. You know, you're not buying it because you actually intend to transact it for goods or services. You're buying it because you think lots of other people are going to buy it and that's going to go up. I think that's a really key distinction, that until they're actually used for commerce, they're little more than, as you put it, experiments.
Yeah, that's a concern as well. You know, people creating altcoins and then, you know, trying to paint Bitcoin as somehow inadequate in one way or another, and that this is better, and trying to just convince people to buy it. I would advise people not to buy altcoins out of, you know, because they want to speculate in them. That's a really risky thing to do. You know, play around and buy altcoins because you're interested in understanding the technology behind them or whatever interesting spins on the Bitcoin idea that they've come up with. But, you know, there have been, you know, obvious pump and dump type scams in the altcoin world, and people need to be cautious about that.
Absolutely. And I think that also with this name of this podcast, obviously, is decentralized, and altcoins are based on a decentralized network. And I think that's something where we're going to see things like Ethereum come out, where it's going to add new services to a decentralized network. And, you know, what do you see as far as where that could go? What else could be done with that? And I know this is kind of a question that is very broad and open-ended, but it's also something where, you know, when we talked to Shooter last week, he was very interested in blockchain technology for distributing music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's possible. It seems to me it would be. And not, maybe not now, but in the future. What else could be done with something as awesome and as really clever as the blockchain?
Oh, gosh, there's a world of possibilities. The first, anytime somebody says, I want to use the blockchain for X, the first thing I think about is, well, how does this event sequencing system and this consensus system apply to that problem? So when you talk about distributing music, which aspects of distributing music does it apply to? Does it apply to the payment for downloading it? Does it apply to the storage of it? Does it apply to the actual distribution, the copying of the bits around? I mean, so I'm not sure what he had in mind about how it would apply to the distribution of music, but that's what I always like to ask, because there's a lot of this. I have this syndrome where I have this hammer, and I'm, you know, suddenly everything looks like a nail, right?
Yeah.
No doubt about it, blockchain is the blockchain technology, the consensus protocol, this event ordering system has enormous applications, but it doesn't apply to everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I always try to think about that and keep that in the back of my mind, like how is this actually relevant to some problem that somebody has? I think in general, any place that you have a trusted third party is potentially going to be impacted or, you know, somehow, you know, made better by blockchain technology, either completely eliminating the trusted third party or, you know, minimizing the dependence on that trusted third party. But I don't know. Specifics, I can see this technology revolutionizing DNS, namespaces of any kind. It can be applied to contracts. It's going to revolutionize accounting. Think about having titles to any kind of property embedded in a blockchain of some kind. And those titles, if they're recognized by governments, they will be your proof of ownership. And transferring ownership will be a matter of trading something on a blockchain. You can even conceive of the ownership of a laptop, for example. You could conceive of that laptop having a private key embedded in it in some kind of tamper-proof chip, and then there being a title that exists in a blockchain, and that title, embedded in that title, is the public key or the address that goes along with that private key embedded in the hardware. And that would be your part of your accounting system if you're a company, and you might have that title on your balance sheet somewhere. And an auditor could come in and say, prove to me, show me the physical assets that go with these titles. And the auditor could go laptop by laptop, confirming the identity of each laptop and matching it up with the title that sits there on the balance sheet of that company. That's huge.
Absolutely.
But that's just one among thousands of applications of this technology. Routing on the internet. I'm starting to see the day where TCP/IP might no longer be necessary. You could come up with a lot of the, you know, technology behind Bitcoin could be used to create a more decentralized and location-independent routing system for the internet. And in addition to that, you can use Bitcoin as the payment mechanism so that when routers sit on the internet and they shuffle bytes from one link to another link, that they're actually making a spread. They're charging one price and paying another price for the delivery of that data, and they're making a cut in between. And you have a device that suddenly becomes just like a coin-operated machine that you plop down somewhere, wire it up, and it starts making money. That will transform the physical architecture of the internet.
I think, and these are big overarching themes, too, that when people think of Bitcoin, they don't necessarily think of things like that immediately. Mm-hmm. They think of, you know, the dollar bills that are in their wallet and that's what is another interesting aspect once you dig deeper is how deep it can go.
And yeah, sometimes I wish they would have named Bitcoin, or Satoshi would have called it Internet 2. That would be a more accurate description of the technology. But because it is, you know, the low-hanging fruit was to solve this problem of payments on the Internet. And because it does solve the problem of payments on the Internet and because it is related to money, that made it exciting and controversial, and that drew attention to it. So if he would have named it Internet 2, maybe nobody would have ever noticed, right? But by naming it Bitcoin and making it related to money, which everybody cares about, mm-hmm. it makes it interesting and it grabs people's attention.
Yeah, I mean, and for me, you know, it's the technical aspect that really got me excited. You know, when I was interviewing with BitPay and eventually when I came here, it was, this is really interesting what it is now, but it was, you know, what this can become, what this is going to be in 5 years, 10 years, mm-hmm. all of the new technologies and ecosystems and platforms that are going to be built on top of this is incredibly exciting. I mean, to me, we have an opportunity right now to really define the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years mm-hmm. of technical progress.
Yeah, and it's all going to be open source, which is great. Another interesting aspect about the ecosystem is that all of these companies are building stuff, you know, all kinds of cool stuff on top of Bitcoin. And for the most part, they're open sourcing it. In a way, I've heard Bitcoin described as the world's first decentralized startup, which I think is a great description of it. But you've got this, you know, new kind of financial instrument that suddenly, you know, individuals and companies can hold. And if they just build cool software, they're going to make it more valuable. And because they make it more valuable, they can fund their own activity, their own development. And so I think the future in and around Bitcoin is very much open source. Bitcoin would have never got off the ground were it not open source. So I think you're going to see lots of companies that follow, lots of new startups that follow the very simple model of buy a lot of Bitcoins and then write some software that makes it more useful, and that will increase the value of those Bitcoins that they have. And, you know, you see it already today with some of the early developers around Bitcoin. They have Bitcoin and they have a self-interest in making that ecosystem better. And so they're contributing to the core protocols and just making it more and more useful to more and more people every day.
Absolutely, and it ensures their growth as a business. It ensures the growth of other businesses that are, you know, based on this. And I think that's really smart. And I also think that if you look throughout other protocols and the internet in general, open source technology has been very important to it. And I think that in Bitcoin, it is essential for if only, and this isn't the only reason, but if only for the reason that it's money. So you want to make sure that, you know, the protocol that is keeping this safe is something that has been gone over multiple times by different people, independent parties, just whoever can, and to make sure that, you know, that's kept honest. So if you keep that honest, it keeps that, you know, third party honest, and everyone wins that's a part of it.
Yeah, I think the future of the software industry is open source. I make a lot of predictions, and I've been successful in making a lot of predictions in my career. Bitcoin was the first one that I could directly monetize, by the way. most of the times that I make predictions, it's based around the economics. And I think if you look at the economics, the future is extremely bright for open source. In fact, I think that 5 or 10 years out from now, almost all software, if not all software, will be open source. All of the really important software will be open source. It's almost that way today already. But it's even going to become more so the case as things like crowdfunding of open source projects, the stuff that Mike Kern is working on, as that stuff matures and becomes reality and people figure out how to make those systems work. I just think that the days of licensed, copyrighted software are over.
Yeah, and one of the cool things that I've began to learn since I started here at BitPay is Git. Git was something I was very unfamiliar with. I knew it as a concept, but I didn't know any of the nuts and bolts of how it works. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that it can be applied to other things besides software, or the open source mentality. And I think it is in some cases, and I think it should be used a lot more in other cases. So I think that you're also going to see, this is my prognostication adding on top of your prediction, will be that you'll see other industries from education to, manufacturing kind of learn that, progress for all is good. Mm-hmm. And, if one company progresses, then we should be able to take that, and then make our product better, and it increases competition, and it really benefits everyone involved in the long term. And I think that's something you're going to see, I hope, obviously, as well. It's an awesome thing to see, and it's an awesome thing to be a part of that. Because when you are, you're just, you're a part of something, and you're trying to build something greater, and it gets better. And I'm getting kind of preachy and, emo here, but it happens. It's interesting and an awesome feeling. So I think that, there is a reward there for every person that takes part in it, too.
Yeah, but I think that's all great, but I don't like to I don't like to rely on systems or make predictions on systems that whose success is, dependent on people's generosity and goodwill.
Okay.
Open source is going to happen because people are greedy, actually, and right. People know that I can go write some open source software and get paid for doing it directly, not indirectly like Red Hat, but directly. They can get paid to produce open source software, and that's what we're on the cusp of. I mean, you're starting to see it with, services like Kickstarter, but that's just the very beginning. We're just scratching the surface of that today. And I think businesses of the future are going to be, software businesses of the future are going to be built around this concept. And it can apply to other things. Any scenarios where you have this, common good that needs to get built can be, built in a Kickstarter-like way.
Yeah. I think in a macro sense that the open source movement is basically almost a form of software evolution.
Mm-hmm.
You're intensifying the feedback cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And, whereas before when you had these licensed releases that were coming out every 8 months, now you post an issue to GitHub and you're getting feedback immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same way really when we start to look at crowdfunding and business models. It's almost like economic evolution in terms of how we look at making money and building organizations,
mm-hmm.
which I think is why we're going to see an even bigger explosion in the diversity of approaches to really every type of enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. With this going ahead, BitPay has been known for supporting the open source movement. I hate using that term, but open source software. Why do you think it's important that not just Bitcoin companies, but software companies in general act now and not in the 5 to 10 years where they'll be forced to for economic reasons, but why now? Like, why is this something that you're putting into action well before them, besides the fact that you truly believe this is where it's going and it's for the economic advantage of, your company?
Well, you just said it.
Exactly.
In 5 or 10 years, it'll be too late for them, mm-hmm. right? And they won't survive. If you think the future is going to be open source, then do it now. Don't wait.
and why should now this is more of a message, not just necessarily saying that, this is something you do, but what would you say to someone who's looking to start up a company in general and they want to keep it open source, but they're not necessarily sure if it's in their economic its advantage again to do that now? What would you say to them? And let's say they are a Bitcoin company, why it's important to not just remain open source, but if they're a Bitcoin company, contribute to the Bitcoin protocol. What's the mindset there to try to explain to someone who's completely naive to the process? What would you say?
find something that needs improvement, that there's a market there of people that want whatever it is you're going to build. A fundamental concept here for any company is build a product that people actually want, right?
Mm-hmm.
So find that product that people actually want. And then instead of trying to build it in a closed-sourced way, go out there and get people to contribute and, to fund the actual building of that. So if it's going to cost you and a team of people $10,000, let's say, to build something, go out there and crowdfund it and convince people to give you $10,000 and then go build it. And then look for software out there like Lighthouse that Mike Kern is building that can help you with that process, that can help you raise those funds. I think that's a great way to start a Bitcoin company. Go out there and try and sell people or convince people that this particular feature or product needs to get built for one reason or another, and then convince people that you're good at building software, and then raise money, right? Do it for cheap to start with, though, right? Maybe not 10 grand, maybe just offer to do it for $1,000 and then prove yourself. And once you have a track record, then you're going to get more people interested in funding your software development in the future.
I think that's fantastic advice. I would also like to say, are there any other open source or, any projects that BitPay is involved in currently that you'd like to speak on? Because there's a bunch of things going on.
Well, of course. There's we have BitCore, which is an open source platform for talking to the real Bitcoin network. We saw a trend 6 months or a year ago where a lot of people were building software that talked to proprietary APIs. And that was bothersome to us for a number of reasons. And we felt like we needed to give people or create a project that made it easy for people to talk to the real Bitcoin network on a completely open source stack. We had taken Stefan Thomas's Bitcoin JS and forked that for some of the stuff that we needed internally. And so we had that fork, and we decided to clean that up and polish it and get it ready for releasing as open source. And sort of as a forcing function, we decided to build a blockchain explorer called Insight as sort of the proof point that this open source framework was usable for something. So BitCore is used by Insight, or powers Insight. And then in addition to that, we have the multi-signature wallet called Copay, which grew out of our own need to maintain funds in a more secure manner and in a multi-signature wallet. So we decided, if we need it, then surely there are lots of other people and companies that also need it, and we should put that out there as open source as well.
Fantastic. And I know there's one other one that I think is interesting as well, is GetBits. And this is really just out there to get people who know nothing about Bitcoin but have a little bit of interest and getting them to find out who they know that has Bitcoin and how they can acquire it. What's the background on that, and how do you feel that can really help out the entire ecosystem to get new users involved?
Yeah, that was really sort of a hobby project and turned into a way that people could leverage Facebook to find friends that could help them get started with Bitcoin is basically what that's all about. It's when you get started with Bitcoin, the first thing you want to do is get Bitcoins, and it can be very difficult to get Bitcoins. But if you can find your friends on Facebook that either have Bitcoins or can help you, get bits,
yes,
that makes that process easier. And there's a lot of information out there that you have to digest if you're trying to get into Bitcoin. Which wallet are you going to use? Which services are trustworthy? It's daunting for somebody that is new to it. And if they have a friend, somebody that they do trust, that can give them advice, tell them which wallet is the best wallet or that they've had success with, or where to go to buy Bitcoins, or maybe they can sell them Bitcoins directly. We felt like that was a good way to introduce. That would be a good way for somebody new to Bitcoins to kind of get started.
Absolutely, I do think it can be daunting, but I will say that as someone who got interested in Bitcoin around 2012,
it's significantly easier now than it was then, significantly. And a lot of that has to do with BitPay and companies like BitPay that have, you know, really improved the user experience. And there's no reason that that's not going to continue to happen and continue to be easier. And, you know, so that more and more novice users can come get involved, you know. And they'll think it's fun. They may think it's interesting. Whatever brings them to the table, you know, there'll be something there where they'll be able to access it in an easier format. And that's, I think that's very important. So I think projects like that in general are essential to getting it out there to the people that may have very little interest in it, but, you know, they hear a friend talking about it, or they see a T-shirt, or they hear something about it, and they go, oh, this is kind of interesting. And then the next thing you know, they go to a store that's accepting it, and they go, huh, I have some of this. And bam, you have a new user, you have someone that, you know, that light bulb turns on, and it happens, and it's kind of awesome.
Yeah, I think right now, what Bitcoin needs, all of what you said about the usability is true, but we still have a very, very long way to go. And I think right now, the next major thing that's really going to be a catalyst for new user adoption is just making it another order of magnitude easier than today, right? And we need some, you know, I feel like the sort of market is waiting on some new innovation, some new application of the technology to a new problem. And I think a lot of the people that came in with this most recent run-up in the price, you know, well, I often describe most people's experiences. They go out, they hear about Bitcoin, they run out, and they buy some, and then they get these Bitcoins, and they say, well, what do I do with them now? But then what happens is a period of a few months pass, and then suddenly there's some new utility of it, and they do then find a reason to have Bitcoins, and they do figure out what to do with them now. And I think this most recent run-up in the price was a reflection of a lot of people buying it for, you know, those reasons, curiosity or one reason or another, but now they're kind of like, well, what next? And so then we're going to find out what next. We're going to see what comes next. And there will be something that comes next that then shows, oh, aha, you mean I can actually buy this new type of domain name with this. Maybe it's Namecoin and using Bitcoins to buy Namecoin. Who knows?
Absolutely. And I think that's why so many people that are in the field are so optimistic about it, is that they've, you know, however long they followed it for, it's been a steady growth, and it's been all positive, and the user experience has gotten better, and it continues to. So it's really positive for everyone involved. I just would like to say thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Sure.
It's been fascinating, and we can't wait to have you back.
Thank you. All right. Thanks, guys.
You can find out more about BitPay and their open source projects at bitpay.com. Follow Stephen Pear on Twitter at @spear, and follow BitPay on Twitter at @bitpay.
And that's all for this week's episode. You can follow Eric on Twitter at @martindale, and myself, Tony, at @tonyswish. If you'd like to find out more about Decentralize, you can find us on the web at decentralizetheworld.net, or follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall. We also are now on Stitcher and iTunes, so be sure to subscribe to both. And I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Eric Martindale.
And I'm Chaz Ferguson. Thanks for joining us.
And that's a wrap.